Hi, so I'm a master's student at Oregon State University, which might explain why half the crowd just left. So, I'm working with Sujaya Rao, and we're studying the interaction of a grass fungus and a fly. The grass is orchard grass. The fungus is Epicloe typhina, also called choke disease, and the fly is Botanophila locata. So I'll just give a brief biology of these organisms. You can see in this photo externally produced stroma of the fungus on orchard grass, and the darker regions in there are feeding damage by the fly. Then I'll give some previous observations in the Willamette Valley, my own observations this past 2008 season, and what I think the significance of those are in the future directions for this study. So first, what is Epicloe typhina? The fungus, it's an endophyte of grass, and it lives systemically within these perennial grasses in orchard grass. And really provides a lot of benefits to the grass host, increases vigor, although in this photo that doesn't appear too vigorous, but it provides anti-herbivore metabolites. But it is considered a pest in orchard grass seed because it chokes off seed production. And that's a critical part for the fungal life stage, where it produces an external stroma, choking off those seeds, and that's important for its sexually reproductive life stage. It's a heterophthalic fungus, which means it needs to outcross. It's an obligate outcrosser. So two different host plants will have two different fungal organisms. Those must outcross in order to produce ascospores that can increase and disperse the fungus. So that's where the fly comes in. The fly will land on an unfertilized stroma. They appear in this kind of white coloration. It's this fleshy tissue. It'll consume the fungal spermatia, then it'll fly off to a different stroma, feed on that, and while it does so, it lays an egg. And then afterwards, it will defecate the previously consumed fungal spermatia and cross-fertilize the fungus. So it sort of serves as a pollinator for this fungus. Then meiosis can occur, the ascospore production ejects these infective propagules of the fungus, so it can disperse its population. And the fly larvae completes its development on a single stroma before falling to the ground in mid to late summer to diapause as a pupae. So previous studies outside of the Willamette Valley showed strong evidence for obligatory mutualism between this fly and the fungus. There's a really interesting work by Thomas Boltman and his colleagues in the late 90s showing this non-random walk behavior of the fly. It'll drag its abdomen around the stroma after it lays an egg, kind of dispersing, kind of maximizing fertilization. And if you'll see on the stroma, you'll see a early fertilization pattern along that line. The viable spermatia were shown in feces. And they were not able to show that these spermatia could transfer in any other means. They're really sticky. They're not airborne. So it really did seem to be kind of an obligatory mutualism. However, in the Willamette Valley, we first saw choke disease in, actually, probably there a little bit earlier, 96 or so, but first report in 97 in orchard grass. And it's quickly spread throughout the region, throughout the orchard grass seed cultivating region, as well as naturalized areas. And in 2002 and 2003, several fields were sampled for fly presence. And what was really interesting is that although fertilization rate on the stroma was consistent throughout, the presence of the fly varied considerably. You can see, for example, field 13 is kind of the extreme where all stroma sampled were fertilized, yet there was no fly presence whatsoever. And you can see how it varies throughout. So this brings up a lot of interesting questions. As this fungus disperses in a non-native habitat, mutualism is often cited as a influencing factor for biological invasions. A lack of a mutualist can inhibit an invader, while the acquisition of one could catalyze this dissemination. So I'm asking, what role does the fly fungus mutualism play for the reproduction and dispersal of this fungus in the Willamette Valley? And does obligatory mutualism describe this fly fungus interaction, or do other conditions in the Willamette Valley allow alternate modes of fertilization? So to start off, I just want to kind of go back. It's 2008 now. Just, are we still seeing that same trend? And to some degree, yeah, we are. There's still a lot of variability in fly presence. It's very common to find fertilized stroma. In fact, it's near 100% fertilization throughout the valley. But fly presence is really variable. So that's what I want you to get from this. So one hypothesis for how this an alternate mode of fertilization is that the ascospores may be functioning as secondary conidia. So what that is, the ascospores are ejected and they're airborne, floating around. It's possible, and some preliminary evidence done by the Agricultural Research Station in Corvallis shows that these ascospores could land on an unfertilized stroma and then subsequently fertilize it, sprout conidia and fertilize it in that way. So in this kind of scenario, you could have an early fertilization event, maybe by a fly, and then these ascospores become airborne and they're able to outcross the remaining flies in the region. And in the densely cultivated grass fields, one plant might be able to get fertilized by a fly that could spread throughout the region and kind of catalyze subsequent fertilization events. So I got this Burkhard spore trap and just wanted to sample, see what the spores look like. Is this a viable explanation? I mean, do we have ascospores in the air early enough to really account for the fertilization we see later in the season? And as we can see here, we really have a very long period of time where there are thousands of ascospores in the air. And this was just from one field, starting on May 2nd, began sampling, and by the 14th of May, we already see ascospores in the air. So that's very early. The previous studies we've sampled to see fertilization rate and fly presence closer to harvest, when you can really see the symptomatic symptoms of fertilization, which is this bright orange coloration on the stroma. And that's towards the end of June. So we have about a month of really high ascospore presence and all the way through. And actually, just another interesting fact on the note on this plot here is that around the 27th and 28th of June is when this field was cut. So you have a drop in ascospore production, and the way they harvest is they leave the grass to dry before they actually get the seeds off of it. So these stroma are laying exposed, and they're able to begin producing spores again. So this could be really important for infection process. So ultimately, the significance, I think, of this is that the timing and duration of ascospore production could explain this variable fly presence. I think this is a viable hypothesis. But it kind of leads to the second question, that if the flies were eradicated, which is not going to happen completely, but if we were to at least limit fly presence considerably, would we see outcrossing? If we could stop these initial fertilization events, would we not see this later fertilization? And so that's what I'm planning on looking at for the duration of my master's. I'm looking at some fly exclusion studies, controlled ascospore fertilization experiments. And also from the other angle, I want to look at maybe the fungus in the valley doesn't need the fly anymore. Maybe it can become fertilized without the fly. But does the fly need the fungus in the same way as before? Does the fungus need the fly to be fertilized? Is that non-random walk behavior? It's really interesting. You know, I would think that some benefit would come out of fertilized stroma versus unfertilized stroma, but we really want to look at a developmental study just to see what those differences might be. And that is all. Thanks. Any questions?
How sticky is that spermatia? Can stick onto another insect that just might be happening to land there?
You know, and that's a good question. And actually, one thing that I want to look at is we've seen in the valley there's really high slug populations. And there's been a few times where I've seen these slugs kind of seeming to prefer the stroma versus the grass. And you'll have one plant and, you know, tillers coming out everywhere and just one stroma, and the slug has just managed to come right up there and it's eating it. So there are other organisms visiting it. It is really sticky. It's not blowing off. It may be because of the density of a cultivated field. We're able to see splash fertilization that you wouldn't really see in the other environments where they've studied it. I think there are a lot of plausible mechanisms for fertilization, other organisms being one of them. And those are all things that we want to look at in the future. Okay. Thanks.
Oh. Was there another question?
Yeah. So.
Right. Well, I mean, so with the spore fertilization, or the ascospore presence, it was just one field, but we do have a lot of atmospheric climate data. They keep a lot of really good data in the surrounding areas, so that's definitely something that I didn't have a chance to look at that prior to this meeting, but that's kind of the next step.
How are your fly densities, or fly population densities, how are they measured?
Okay, so another thing I did not present today was I have spatial data on fly presence and abundance at these various sites, and it really varies a lot. I haven't mapped that out yet. So the field that you saw in the 2003 studies where there was zero fly presence, there are flies there now. And it's still low densities, but there seems to be fly movement. They're laying eggs throughout the season. So they seem to be moving a lot, but it kind of seems to depend on infection pressure. They are attracted to a pheromone, previous studies have shown. And I think that might be what's influencing their abundance, but we do want to look at what the limits to that are. So.
Thank you.